All right. Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Thanks for being here, and there's so many of you in the room. I hope you all had a chance to get some breakfast and maybe catch up with each other. The room is a little bit bigger laid out at this point. If you're wondering, something's different. That's true. It's we have more tables at this point. Switched to Monday morning meetings, and Faculty Senate meets in the afternoon, and this is their setup. So if it looks a little bigger, that's true. It is bigger. But anyway, welcome, and I want to start with the roll call.
Chris Beck.
Here.
Faye Gallant.
Here.
Chad Olson.
Here.
Evelyn Pinsgaard. Melody Hughes. Allie Englert.
Here.
Leslie Walls.
Here.
Jessica DeRochers. Jamie Warwick.
Here.
Susan Mitchell.
Here.
Jesse Atencio.
Here.
Chris Brooks.
Here.
Mercedes Anderson.
Here.
Matthew Mund.
Here.
Jane Grossclose.
Here.
Kim Eames.
Here.
Susan Carson.
Here.
Stacey Houdeshell.
Here.
Samara Tabor.
Here.
Brandy Marrero.
Here.
Jeff Baxter.
Here.
Dino Jolliffe.
Here.
Jessica McCallum.
Yes.
Susan Sanborn.
Here.
Brad Crick.
Here.
Nate Bauer.
Here.
Richard Machida.
Here.
Janelle Merrifield.
Here.
Philip Jacobs.
Here.
Selena Brown. Trish Winters.
Here.
Constance Huizinga. Jim Jones. Anyone whose name I did not call? Quorum was met.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Welcome to all the new members. Thank you for serving on staff council. I'd like to move on to approval of the agenda for today.
So moved.
So moved. Okay. Do I hear a second? Any discussion or addition to the agenda? Hearing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. We have an agenda. Then I'd like to welcome Chancellor Rogers this morning and have him have the floor.
Well, thank you, Chris, and welcome to the to this in-person meeting. And Sherry and I are happy to host the staff council breakfast each year, an opportunity to get together with staff council members. And it's really, in some ways, for me also, it's recognizing our best unpaid staff member in Sherry, who ends up working full-time essentially as in the development office, helping us raise money for UAF, joins me in the activities as we try to make a difference to the university. And I appreciate that you've modified your schedule to meet on Mondays. Some of you may be aware I've missed more staff council meetings in the last year than ever before, and that's because the president sets his cabinet meetings for Tuesday mornings, and it has been right on top of the staff council meeting for almost every meeting in the last year. And so when I've been able to call in for some, but I much more appreciate the opportunity to meet in person and to be able to answer questions that you may have, particularly during what we know is going to be a challenging time. I did want to add one item, though. I know you have staff achievements and highlights, and I really appreciate that you call out some of the great things that staff have done. There's one that's not on here yet that I want to call out, and that was the response to the steam line break last week. We had as most people know, we had a steam line break that actually caused then a water line break, and it meant that that first we had steam damage and steam filling up Walsh Hall, where 12 residents live, but the turning off the steam and the water line break meant that we had neither heat nor nor water at Hess Village, Harwood Hall, Stewart Hall, the Chancellor's House, the Fire Hall, the Chandelier Street houses, and Bunnell House. And so that affected lots of people. But the mobilization of staff to address the issue, first to figure out how we were going to get the steam line fixed, second, and to focus on that at 40 below, to figure out how we were going to get everyone notified who had children at Bunnell House, which we couldn't legally operate once we had no water. And then over the course of the day, facilities is working, trying to get everything back online, Res Life is figuring out what are we going to do with 200 people. And so by the mid-afternoon, at least we had heat back on, so we knew we were not going to lose buildings, but we still didn't have water. Residence Life had arranged rooms and transportation and vouchers for 200 people to locate off campus to cover their meals and transportation. Now, facilities managed to get the water back on before we had to mobilize that. But the fact is, we were able to stand up in an emergency, move quickly at 40 below, and we all know how hard that is. And just a remarkable response. And I want to highlight that kind of response really makes all of us, I think, proud of what each office at UAF is able to do. We had long-term problems at Walsh Hall. Repairs needed there. Mike, I don't know if everybody's back in yet or not. If you could.
Not in Walsh Hall.
Okay.
Walsh
Hall will be down for a while because of the damage, the amount of steam that went in, and that's a real shame. But it really points to what it means to have older facilities, and we've been dealing with that. Not in the press. We had one of our boilers down last week also. You've heard me talk for years about the problems with combined heat and power. Well, we had another leak in the boiler, had to bring boiler one down. It takes a few days to cool down, then you weld to fix, and then you start it up again. So in the midst of all that, we were also down with one of the two coal boilers. We have enough backup with the oil, but that's a continuing problem in dealing with old facilities. And I'm really pleased that the legislature stepped up last year to get us funding for combined heat and power. Obviously, it's a tough legislative year, a tough budget year for the state with a $6.5 billion budget with a $3.5 billion hole in the budget. I'm really pleased, and I think the president and board are as well, that Governor Walker has prioritized K-12 and higher education. Yes, there is a budget reduction for us, but among all of the state agencies, K-12 and higher education had the smallest budget reduction. But more importantly, Governor Walker has recognized that we took a cut this year, unlike many of the other parts of state government, and he's used that as an example of response to the budget. And I think that will help us as we move into the legislative process. The legislature wants to cut more. So, at this point, what we saw in the governor's budget is probably the best that we will do. Much as was the case last year, the legislature cut a little bit more. We're trying to lay out for them what the impact of the reductions are. And I think the fact that we lost 160 positions in the last year has people understand that that's real. And just if we look at October of 2013 to October 2014, there were 160 fewer people on the payroll. 55 of those full-time, permanent, regular positions. 105 of those were part-time, temporary, or student positions. So about two-thirds, one-third were regular positions. But of that, if we compare that to what we're facing in the next year, we're looking at somewhere on the order of 200 to 250 positions in all. Again, I would guess about a third of those will be regular faculty and staff positions, two-thirds temp and student positions, and to give a sense of comparison, over the last year, there were a total of 18 layoffs, of which about half of the people we were able to find alternate positions so far within UAF. So, essentially, I expect the ratios to be about the same. We continue to look for places other than people, but we're a people industry. That's what higher education is. We run on the faculty and staff that teach, that do the research, that provide the support, that provide the services. And so, when our budget's cut, a major part of that ends up being people. But I appreciate even little steps like having faculty senate and staff council meet using the same setup and saving one setup. We're going to have to be looking for every possible savings like that we can. And I'd encourage each of you in your own areas and across areas to say, have you thought about this? Here's a way that we can reduce our non-personnel expenses. Because ultimately, because we're a people organization, it's going to be based on people that we make it through and recover from this. Many of you were here in the 80s when we went through bigger budget reductions. We made it through. It was painful. We lost friends who ended up moving out of state. People, we saw the whole economy of Alaska affected. We could see something akin to that, but on a more gradual basis over the next 2 or 3 years. And I think the key is we did make it through that, and we became a strong university again. And I think we can do that again this time. And it's going to be through the creativity of the staff and the faculty at UAF that we make it through. We continue to look for, in addition to any specific program areas, we look for anything that cuts across all areas. And you're going to see some changes. We have on the pay side, we intend to go forward assuming the legislative funding of half of the pay. We intend to go forward with the pay package that we discussed last fall. When we look at universities elsewhere that have gone through this level of cut, we generally see pay freezes and some rollbacks. And so I think going forward, after this year, I think we'll probably go through a couple of years without significant pay movement. But in this year, the plan is to go forward. That may be affected, though, by some other pay and benefit issues that we're looking at. We're trying to, and we'll try to do as much as possible on the affecting future employees and not current employees. Don't really know exactly where all that will go yet. We have done. We are reviewing 46 academic programs, looking at the programs in terms of the programs were selected based on low enrollment, falling enrollment, or low graduation rates. That gave us the list to look at. Now we look at how critical are they to the future of Alaska? How fundamental are they to the mission of UAF? How do they connect with the research program? What are the potentials for change? Several of the programs have come back in their special program reviews and said, if we changed the program like this, we think we could change the student numbers. And so that work should be finished in the next month by the faculty committees. That then comes to the cabinet for decision. We will be offering fewer degrees and certificates in future years than we are today. You can't cut the budget at the level we're cutting without affecting that. We've also done a series of special program reviews, more to come, looking at some of the support areas. Again, looking to say, can we do this more efficiently, more effectively? Can we do without? One area I don't want to cut is what we've been doing in the training. From my first day on the job, the staff council has said we need better training, and so we really worked hard to try to first establish a supervisory training program, and then to try to improve the supervisors training program, and I think we're getting close there. The safety training, we've been pushing really hard for the last 3 years on that. 90% of regular employees now have completed all the safety training modules. Title IX training, remarkable response there. We're at 95% of regular employees have finished the Title IX training. The protection of minors training, which was supposed to be completed by December 31st, we were at 50% as of December 31st. But we were at zero as of August 1st, so we're making some headway. But if you haven't finished that training, we are going to try to move that one up. And then bullying awareness training, that's rolling out now so that we're trying to, again, improve that. And particularly in an organization that's going through a lot of change, it's real easy to say, oh, well, let's put training off to another time. And the answer is no. We need to keep doing that so that people who move from office to office are able to make those personal changes. I know talking before this, several of you have changed jobs in the last year or 2 years, and you know that having that training makes a difference there. Real quick, Cornerstone nominations. Just a reminder, those the Chancellor's Cornerstone Award nominations are due this month. If you've got somebody you want to recognize, please let's sort of follow up on what you've been doing on staff achievements and highlights to recognize the best staff around. I'm going to stop now, and I'd be happy to answer questions. I'm sure there are some. Please ask.
Go ahead, Brad.
Chancellor Rogers, I apologize. So this is a somber question. I'm not sure how best to phrase it. I think we probably all know we've had three fatalities on campus in the last 2 years. I was sort of looking back, and I found that we had a fatality on campus six years ago. So we've had four on campus in the last 6 years. Is that something that we're talking about? Are we looking at these events and looking at, are there ways that we could help our community and things that we could do?
Yes, I think, as part of the residence life training and as part of residence life staffing, there is regular work in that area. I think ensuring that we continue to have adequate health and counseling is a real key. Beyond that, the issue particularly of suicide awareness and ensuring that people people know what they can do. We've got one major effort that's in progress, that's really focused, came out of the Alaska Native community, a movie that's in production right now called We Breathe Again that has involved some faculty and some staff, as well as people from around the state, in producing a movie on suicide awareness and suicide prevention. UAF is one of the three major sponsors of that film, and that's really designed to help people understand what you can do to be aware of the issues of suicide and what you can do to help if you sense that someone is at risk. And I think that's probably the key, is understanding who's at risk and what you can do about it.
Yep, thank you. Yeah, I feel odd asking the question, in part because you can't say that there's so many factors that go into it. I don't want to treat any person as though there's one set of circumstances that would fit everyone, but if we look beyond just what happens on campus, if we ask, if we ask people in the room, about events that they know of in their life, friends, family, acquaintances, I think we probably all know someone who's no longer with us, and that's a hard thing.
Yes.
Do we have any questions on the phone?
If you're thinking of a question, so is someone else, so go ahead and ask it.
I have a question. You mentioned in regards to training that you're in support of employee training for job development. Will that also hopefully trickle down to encourage their department levels to continue professional development? Because unfortunately, a lot of the professional development does require travel, and with the cut in travel, that makes departments not willing to put forth the effort or the funds to continue professional development.
That is a key problem. The legislative reduction to travel, which really hit us by about 15% of unrestricted travel this year, really has one of the major optional pieces of travel is for professional development. And when we look at what is optional and what isn't, the instructional travel and research travel that is not paid by restricted or private funds are ones we can't cut. And so, in fact, we have seen a reduction in travel for professional development. So to me, that says a couple of things. One, for professional development, we look internally. Do we have people here that can do the training? Two, can we bring people here? Because paying for someone else to come here comes out of a contractual line rather than out of the travel line. And three, how do we step up what we're doing on staff appreciation, staff development at the end of the year? And can we encourage more people to allow time for classes that are offered by one of the university departments that are professional development? I don't have a solution because we had a specific cut to travel and have to demonstrate that we have cut travel, and that's been a challenge in a number of departments. And certainly, there's not a fix for when you've got a shrunk budget. We're not going to be able to travel as much for professional development.
I have a personal example, and that is that I've been trying to obtain a master's certification in contracting, and unfortunately, these classes are not offered here. And I'm two classes short, and I have to complete them within the next year, and it does not look like through the funding I'm going to be able to, and I'm going to lose that opportunity.
Leslie, one thing you might want to look into that I know UAS has done before is they've brought that related to that master's certificate in contracting. We've had that course at UAS with people come up.
Particular classes that have been brought here I've already taken.
These all of them,
very
okay.
Specific classes. And it takes eight to get that master's certification, and I've got six. And I've already gotten a year extension on it, too. So. Just as an example.
And you know, I think we're going to see more and more stories like that. In fact, if others have specifics on the impact of the travel cut that and how that affects our ability to do what we do, If you could send them to OMB so that we can collect those. Travel's an legislature seems to think of travel as being an easy thing to cut. I've tried to come up with examples that help them understand why it's not. The one that I've gotten through with a few of them is to say, yeah, our basketball team's only going to travel with 4.2 basketball players now because we don't have enough travel for the whole one. Well, you know, of course that's ridiculous. But to try to point to them that there are things that you know you have to spend money in order to do what we do.
I think we can say too that for those of us who can get our professional development, you know, contact hours through things that are available locally or at UAS, the more those of us who are able to do that take advantage of that, that kind of frees up some of the resources for people who just don't have that option. I know one person in my office has a very specific certification that takes a huge amount of contact hours, and usually he gets those through a conference that is pretty intensive. But this year he's taking a class at UAS that's going to because it's an ongoing class throughout the semester, is going to put him way over the number of hours he needs, actually, so he'll be able to maintain his certification. So I think where opportunities like that arise, if we can encourage people in our units and our departments to seek those out, that's something we can do proactively as well.
I have a question. I've noticed within my department a lot of concern about what kind of timelines will be affected by pay changes or the status of different things having to do with pay. And I know you mentioned it a minute ago. Do you have a timeline that you could provide to give us a picture of when we might know more about different stages of that?
I can give some. There are key decisions that are made outside of UAF, and those first by the governor, then by the legislature, then by the Board of Regents. So some key dates that I can give you right now, the governor's final budget is due on February 17th or so. The legislature is scheduled to adjourn on April 20th. We'll have a pretty good idea. We think we know everything in the governor's budget, but there could be some. He has the ability to make changes between now and February 17th. The legislature then, if they don't go into special session, would finish by April 20. The House Finance Committee is scheduled to make its budget closeout on February 23rd in subcommittee and February 24th in full committee, so pretty quickly. That will give us a pretty good sense of where the legislature is headed. Of the two houses, the House seems more intent on cutting further than the Senate. So sort of if you figure the governor's here and the House comes in here, we're going to be somewhere in between those. That'll give us a much better idea. The Board of Regents has three meetings that will affect decisions. They meet February 18 to 20, immediately following the governor's final budget. They meet April 8th to 10th, and then they meet on the first week of June, the 5th and 6th, 4th and 5th. So the board's decisions, which are the ones that make the final call, that'll be that first week of June. But we have a pretty good idea now of the best case, what the governor's already announced. By the end of the month, pretty good idea of how much further the legislature will go. So if there are layoff decisions to be made, I would expect those to begin rolling out in early March. I think that final decisions on programs are more likely to be in the April time frame. And of course, the new fiscal year starts July 1. We can't really make our final calls on many items until we have that legislative number to work with.
Thank you.
Excuse me, Chancellor. This is Kim Eames, and I just want to follow up on what you just said about the final decision on the programs could be made in April. Are you talking about those 46 programs that are on the special review list?
In terms of the cabinet decisions, yes.
Cabinet being the legislature?
No, cabinet being UAF cabinet.
Okay.
The suspension of a degree program is an administrative decision. The final decision on program elimination is made by the Board of Regents, and that would most likely be at a later date over the course of the following academic year.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I'm confused because you earlier said that there should be a first decision And that's at the faculty level by the end of the month, correct?
Yes.
And then it goes to a...
So the process on program elimination begins with the special program review. Those recommendations then come to an administrative committee and to the Chancellor's Cabinet. A decision at Chancellor's Cabinet would be to suspend admission into the program and then to begin working on the plan for phasing out. The Board of Regents ultimately decides which program, on the addition or deletion of any program. We have a responsibility, if there are students in a program, to teach out the program. And so it can take 2 or 3 years before we move to program deletion.
Thank you, sir. I'm taking notes here because there's several CLA programs, and so there's lots of staff that are wondering if they'll have jobs in the fall. So thank you. That helps.
And there are several programs in just about every one of our colleges and schools that are affected, and I know this is a very challenging time for everyone in those programs. I wish there were a better solution. If anybody has an idea of how to get oil prices up or oil production up, I'd really appreciate that.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
So just before we wrap up, I want to, if any of our new members have questions and you're feeling shy because you think we might already have the answers in the rest of the room, please don't hesitate. If we've already covered it before, it's no problem to cover stuff again. So,
I want to echo what Faye just said, because often, you know, people can be worried. Well, what if everybody else knows this? And the fact is, probably they don't. But more importantly, it helps me. The kinds of questions that you ask me in staff council help me understand what's on staff mind, and that's part of the communication process between the administration and the staff. It's important for me to know what those concerns are, and that factors into decision making. And that's one of the that's part of the value of having a staff council in that interaction with the university administration.
So, Chancellor Rogers, on sort of the budget realities, we know, of course, that system-wide furloughs or campus-wide furloughs, you know, could potentially be coming. They're now a tool that's available. But I've heard that here on campus, departments and offices are being told that if they want to do voluntary leave without pay, they could do that. And I'm wondering if that's the case, what would happen if, you know, then we had, say, a UAF-wide furlough or a system-wide furlough? You know, would some offices basically take furlough twice, or would there be some consideration?
Great question, and one that that your leadership raised with me last week, and we haven't yet put out a definitive answer on that. But I can tell you, if we don't give some consideration for those who take voluntary leave without pay or voluntary contract reductions, nobody's going to take voluntary. So it makes sense to me that we would essentially say, if you are taking voluntary leave without pay and we then have to impose a furlough, that your days of voluntary leave without pay count toward that furlough. But we've not had any – I'll be raising that with my cabinet at my next meeting as to how we get that policy out there and communicate it. But it would not – in my mind, it would not be reasonable if people are taking voluntary to say, oh, thank you for the week of voluntary. Now we're going to penalize you with another week of involuntary, or however many days it may be. So thank you for raising that one, because that's a really important issue for us to address early, because there are some people that are willing to, rather than see layoffs in their area, are saying, well, what if everybody takes 2 weeks less? Can we hold on to more workers and balance that workload? And that's not an easy choice to make, because that affects pay. But the alternative is one of our coworkers no longer has a job, or we're unable to fill that essential position. And so thanks a lot for raising that one. That one, we will get that one addressed and get it addressed quickly. But my sort of instant response is, of course, we would have to recognize that voluntary time or that contract reduction. If there are some offices that are looking at what if they reduce everybody's contract by 2 weeks, we would have to recognize that in a furlough situation. Thank you.
Chancellor, what is your communication plan for talking with the community and the business leaders in Fairbanks about building support for UAF and for the economic impacts of these cuts?
Well, I began that with the speech to the Greater Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce and the Republican luncheon 2 weeks ago to lay out what the impact is of this of the level of budget reduction we're looking at, so that they understand. And I think when the slide that says this is the equivalent of Flint Hills closing twice, I could see the shock on the faces in the chamber. They get it. They understand what that means for this community, and sort of the legislators. You know, this is not they're reeling from the drop. You know, seeing a 50% drop in the price of oil, that's hitting everybody hard. So they understand that, and I think I don't think there's a whole lot we need on top of that. We need to do to push for support. However, how you translate support into 45 cents on the dollar of revenue, that's the hard piece. And really the big question in my mind is going to come not this year, but in the next year as the state starts looking to the revenue side. There are very few states or local governments that don't have some form of broad-based tax, and Alaska's going to have to look at a broad-based tax. Is that at the state level income, sales, or property, or is it some impact on the permanent fund dividend? That's a discussion the state's going to have to have. And it's at that point that people then have to trade off how much do we value the university versus how much are we willing to pay. And that's going to be a difficult discussion because it's been over 30 years since Alaska has had a broad-based tax on individuals. Some of us remember paying a personal income tax to the state. Some of us remember when we didn't have a permanent fund dividend. That's a difficult discussion. And I think that the public is not ready for that discussion until they see what the real impacts are of this year's budget reductions. But that's a discussion that we will have to have, and we will need the support of this community. And you know how much people love taxes in Alaska. Well, thank you all for what you do to help keep this institution moving forward. I am convinced we'll make it through, and that having seen how resilient we were in the 80s, I know we can be that resilient in this century as well. And thanks to each of you for what you do for this university.
Thank you, Chancellor. I just thank you for breakfast as well as for being here and answering our questions. Much appreciated. Thank you, Sherry, for being here as well. Thank you so much. All right, moving on to the next order of business. Public comment. Is there anybody here for public comment or on the phone? Okay. Then let's move on to status of pending actions. Leave share resolution is passed, right?
Yes, we did manage finally to get a resolution passed at Staff Alliance. So for our new members, that's the leadership of the staff councils from UAA, UAF, UAS, and statewide. We have a Staff Alliance group that works on any issues that impact the entire system. And so changes to the leave share policy would be one of them. And we did just get a resolution passing that in support of both the UAF resolutions as written, by Jeff, thank you. This is to make it so that both if you're on intermittent family medical leave, you know, if you come back to the office for 4 hours to wrap stuff up, right now as the policy stands, that would disqualify you. The clock would reset for another 2 weeks before you qualified for leave share. So this revision includes family medical or intermittent leave, so if you come back, you're okay for a short period. And it also adds bereavement to the qualifying circumstances for leave share. So if you use your leave, your family medical, you know, if you use your leave, you're on family medical leave, caring for a loved one, and people donate leave to you during that time. Right now, if you then move on to bereavement leave, and you've used all your leave, you're just on leave without pay. But by adding bereavement leave to the leave share option, your coworkers can still donate sick leave to you to cover during that time. So this was a response to an issue that a staff member had. It's awful that that staff member had that issue, but I'm really glad that we're finally able to kind of see some movement forward to address that and prevent it from happening again. So thank you so much, Jeff, for your work spearheading that initially. I'm very glad to see it going forward out of Staff Alliance.
It took a little bit, but I think this is something that's been worked on for about 6 months. So, but it's passed, and I'm really glad that it did. The emergency leave policy, there is a kind of a temporary policy that was set for this year, and they are working on a final policy for future years. And that was sent out early December, I believe, for this year, and we've got added 2 days of sick leave that can be used for emergency leave, and that will be an official category coming July 1st, I believe. That's still on the Board of Regents agenda. But hopefully this coming month that'll be official and be decided on.
And just again as a reminder, because it's been a while, that's if, you know, if there's a weather event, for example, an ice storm, the chancellor can declare an emergency leave day, and so that employees who can't make it to work can charge those 2 days of sick leave as emergency leave, which was a ongoing problem for staff has been, you know, the roads are horrible, I can't come in. Everybody knows the roads are horrible, but I'm supposed to come in if I can, but I'm out of leave, so maybe I'll risk it so I can get paid. And it was a tricky situation. So for now, 2 days of sick leave available for that. And then, as of next year, there'll be an
administrative leave
category added in and into our negotiated rates so that people on restricted funds can charge that as well, which has been the big problem for UAS. So.
Yeah, so there's movement on that. Hopefully more on that next month. Moving to officer reports, a lot of stuff the Chancellor's already covered. A couple things. Planning and Budget Committee hasn't met since Christmas break. We were kind of waiting on a budget coming out, as well as results from the special program reviews, as well as some of the on the academic side, as well as some of the special program reviews that were ongoing last year on the non-academic side. They are currently wrapping up, and I suspect that the Planning and Budget Committee will probably reconvene sometime this month. Furlough draft regulations, that task force has concluded, and the final version of the regulations, I think, is included with this agenda. Please feel free to look that over and provide feedback. You can send that to Nicole. There's a lot of back and forth and a lot of things that have changed or added, and some really good suggestions that have come forward on that. The policy has passed, but the regulations are still in draft form, so there's things that can be changed there. And then two other things regarding some policies. There's a safety policy coming from for UAF. We'll have a draft of that later this month to look over. And then the protection of minor policy that was that UAF has already in place is actually going statewide. So all of the universities in the state will have that same or very similar policy that UAF already does. That's really all I had, unless you have any questions for me. All right, Faith?
Okay. Yes, okay. I have a few things. One, touching on what the Chancellor said earlier, if you have cost savings or revenue-generating ideas, especially ones that you can't just implement within your own department, but if they need kind of more support or need to go up to a higher level, there is a form at uaf.edu/omb. There's a little bubble that you can click on that says, got cost-saving ideas? If you submit those come to my office and we share them up either with the committees that are working on those topics or through to the provost and chancellor as needed. And then they'll be shared with planning and budget committee when they reconvene as well. But we've seen some really good ones coming through so far that have moved on to committee. Trish sent a couple that were really got some interest right away. You guys are out there. We're all out there as staff. We see things. We hear things. We have a really broad range of expertise. And so if you have ideas, like the Chancellor said, even a little thing like cutting the duplicate setup for Staff Council and Faculty Senate does make a difference. So please share those. And again, that's just uaf.edu/omb. Also on the OMB website, there is info about the program reviews, and there's a link to the provost website that has the information about the academic program reviews. But if you just want a little more context or to see what these committees were charged with, you can see those on the OMB website, and as the final reports come out and are accepted, they'll be published there as well, just if you have questions about those or about the process. We'll also have Julie Queen, the Director of the Office of Management and Budget, will be at our next Staff Council meeting to give an update on the legislative budget process, where things are going, and answer questions. So we'll have that again this year. She came last year, and it was a very robust discussion, I think. So.
And we'll have more ideas regarding budget anyway from the legislature as well. So.
Yeah, at that point we'll have a little bit more certainty to speak to. So, and then finally, also related to what the Chancellor was saying about training and employee development actually being critical when we're looking through hard budget times as opposed to something that's fluff that can be cut. In relation to the training and employee development team that Jessica leads, there will be a survey going out this month across campus. The target is to reach all employees, and it'll kind of take through what training do you need, what training are you getting, are you not getting the training you need either to do your job or to advance in your career, and kind of map some of these things out with the goal that we want people, as we change as an organization, which we no doubt will be, we want the people we have to be able to meet the needs that we have in the future. So if that's different, then how do we get our current employees to the places, to the job skills that they might want to go into? So it will probably be a pretty robust survey, but I would absolutely encourage you and ask you to encourage people in your unit to take the time to respond to that. I think it will shape the team's recommendations, and it will be shared, the results will be shared as well up through the Chancellor, and will strengthen some of our it'll strengthen our case for the need for a maintained focus on employee development, professional development, and key trainings as we go ahead into the next couple of years. So that'll be coming. If you have questions about it, you can feel free to contact either me or Jessica, and we'll keep you posted.
Okay.
Any questions?
All right. Thanks, guys. Moving forward to governance reports, Matthew from ASUF, are you on the phone? Okay. How about Dabu Misra from Faculty Senate?
I think he might be calling in later. He has a class.
Oh, okay. All right. Then we'll leave that for later. Then moving right along. Staff achievements and highlights. We had actually three this this time. I talk about the first one because the Office of Sustainability contacted me and said, "Hey, did you know CRCD staff, 16 employees there, staff employees there, match the sustainability fee that every student pays on campus? It's $20, and the staff got together and decided to match that and paid the $20 sustainability fee as well and made that donation to the Office of Sustainability, and they would encourage other departments to do the same. But I thought it was a very very nice gesture to kind of assist with that as well.
So on the next one, I used a lot of acronyms in here. Three staff members from the Office of Grants and Contracts Administration, Rosemary Maddox, their executive director, Andrew Gray, the associate director, and Samantha Aylshire. They were published, they had an article they wrote published in the National Council of University Research Administrators magazine, which is, for those of you in the research administration field are familiar with it. For those of you not, it's the national organization for this field, and it's a pretty big deal. So it's great to see UAF staff being out there nationally as having expertise that they're sharing with universities all around the country and around the world as well. So that was a great thing to see.
Yeah. And then Ben Stacy, who is the UAF water plant manager, was appointed by Governor Walker to the Water and Wastewater Works Advisory Board. Which is a big deal for UAF and for the state as well.
So just a reminder on this one, if you guys hear about things in your units or you want to share any of these, you're certainly free to share them now, free to share them when we have this. Or if you would rather submit them in advance, you can just email them to Nicole or to me or Chris, as you think of them or as you hear of them. But I think it is really important to recognize the level of expertise and service that we have in our staff at UAS. So does anyone have anything to add to the staff achievements and highlights? Okay.
Okay, anyone on the phone? Okay.
So we're a little bit ahead now, but I think it would be a good time to take our break.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's
fine, yeah. And so let's say 15 minutes.
Yeah.
A nice long one.
And well, I don't know. I think Carl's going to come in person. So let's take a 15-minute break. We'll take it from there. Thanks.
Okay. So, again, just a reminder, please do not put us on hold if you're on the conference, because when you do that, you create hold music that everyone in the room and everyone on the phone hears. And we can't proceed while the music is playing. So just for future reference, please don't use the hold button if you're on the audio conference. Thank you.
All right, thanks. We're back. We've got the next item. Our guest speaker today is Carl Kowalski. Yeah, he's the CITO of the University of Alaska. And we've got a proposed mobile device security policy. We talked about that a little bit in the exec board, and there were enough questions there that I said, Carl, would you come to our meeting and maybe talk a little bit about that and answer any questions that might pop up. So, Carl, thanks for coming.
No problem. Thanks, Chris. Can you guys hear me? Okay. First I came in, and everybody had one of these glasses like Chris in their hand, and I said, wow, this group has wine at 9 in the morning? Can I join? And apple juice. It's apple juice. Thanks for having me today. As you all know, we've proposed a mobile device security policy for the Board of Regents to consider, and we've sent you also some draft regulations to look at. There's a couple things that drove our need to put a policy in place. One, the proliferation of mobile devices everywhere, all over the place. You can't get away from them anymore. And another was each of the campus CIOs were asked to identify the top IT risks that they see on their campuses to UA's internal audit department. And surprisingly, number one was mobile device security and our inability to regulate and keep track of a lot of mobile devices that are on our network. And the third was internal audit chose as their IT audit this year mobile device security. And what internal audit uses are COBIT standards, control objectives for IT. They're national standards for IT procedures and policies. And the number one thing that they look at when they begin any type of audit is what policies and procedures do you have in place, then whether or not you're following them, and then they do risk analysis after that to see if there's been any deviation from policy and practice. Well, right away it was very clear we didn't have a mobile device security policy for them to actually measure us against, so we'll be measured against the COBIT standards. So we went and we looked at other universities to see what they had in place, and the policy before you is a compilation of many, University of Indiana, University of Illinois, West Virginia, and we looked at what might fit for the University of Alaska, and this is what's proposed in going forward. I wasn't surprised. The draft policy went to all the governance groups and to the chancellors and to the CIOs, and everybody said, yep, policy looks good. You move that forward, but we want to know about the regs. I think, as we all know, with any policy, the real meat is into the day-to-day operations, how it's interpreted, and how it will be put into practice. So before you, you have draft regulations, and those address the protection of university non-public information, the reporting and loss of equipment, use of personal mobile devices on the university network, securing those mobile devices, certain requirements when traveling overseas, and then compliance. Some are pretty straightforward. There are many countries that don't allow you to encrypt your computers. There are many countries that as soon as you connect to a wireless or mobile network, they have access to your machine, and they will be monitoring all traffic. In those type of situations, it's going to be important to protect university non-public information. That could be research data. That could be HR data. It could be student data that you may have on either a university device or a public device. And the policy and regs are not written as a gotcha. They're written more as an awareness and an education for people. We've had folks travel like, gosh, I didn't know that. So we provide a loaner laptop when they travel. And I guess I saw part of the concern, and we've had other feedback from student groups and some of the faculty. What's after regulations is going to be guidelines and best practices, and that's where our security team, folks in IT, we're going to help you not only protect university assets, but I think some of these will help you protect your own. I didn't bring any today, but at any of the help desks, you can find a pamphlet that we've got, 10 tips for protecting your mobile device. And we're going to be providing more of those type of things, ways to encrypt your data, and if you are voluntarily using your laptop or a smartphone to do work for the university, how you can best protect those assets in case it's lost in an airport or stolen at a restaurant or someplace along the way. So with that introduction, I'll stop and I'll answer whatever questions you may have that are burning.
So for those of you following along on the agenda, on page 13 are those draft regulations that Carl is speaking about. So if you want them in front of your face, that's where you will find them.
Send out the 10 tips for those of us that can't make it to your office to pick one up?
Yes, we can. I'll get it to Chris and he can distribute it.
Can those 10 tips go out like in the cornerstone or something? Possible like that, more wide, just because resident life we do have.
Dean, is there a differentiation in the regulation between university owned and personally owned? Not just differentiating, but emphasis.
There is. You know, the we don't have as much of a problem protecting data on university-owned devices. If it's been stolen or you feel it's been compromised, they've got a virus and there's strange activity on it, we can come get university assets and inspect them and make sure that the data hasn't been stolen or something nefarious has happened to that data. We have a section in there marked personal mobile devices because I think, as you all know, many of us do work voluntarily on our own device, whether it's at home, whether it's a personal laptop, whether it's your smartphone. You may be doing grades. You may have a spreadsheet of HR data. You may have a spreadsheet of student data. Some file you're processing you took home just because you said, oh, I'm going to knock this out this weekend and get it done. And not realize that, gosh, what happens if somebody steals that laptop? And I've got a spreadsheet with names, dates of birth, credit card information, Social Security numbers that I was processing for HR or finance. That's where the real difficulty comes in. So what the policy and regs are intended to do is to let everyone know that if you're doing that type of work on a personal device, you are responsible for the safety of that data in your custody.
Beyond responsible, but liable?
You know, I think the lawyers upstairs would say yes. You know, it's like taking a car. It's like borrowing, you know, the golf cart that the facilities folks drive around. If you borrowed that and did something personal with it, yes. If you borrowed a car and you got an accident with it, yes. If you have university assets in your possession and they weren't adequately protected, yes.
Was referring more to the data than the actual device.
I'm looking at data as an asset. It may be intangible, but it is property of the university that would not be otherwise publicly released.
So it's a one of the scary to me when I was reading it, sequestration. You know, that just sounds so scary. So if I have a device that's got university information, or if my account is compromised, you know, are there circumstances under which OIT is going to say, well, we need to see your personal devices so that we can check them? You know, what would that look like in practice?
Okay, the answer to the second part is yes, we will ask. And the first part, we've gotten rid of the word sequester. it was a very loaded term. In practice, what would happen is, our security team has devices and software in place that can monitor network traffic. And say we see a device that's sending strange quantities of data to China. They're going to say, gosh, look at this device with this IP address is sending out data. And it traces to your cell phone, your laptop. We're going to come to your office and we're going to say, hey, you know, we've seen this strange information. We'd like to look at your laptop and see if you've been infected, or, you know, maybe you're corresponding with someone and there's a legitimate use for that happening. You married someone and you've just sent all your family photos at home. I did have an experience like that, and I'll share in a second. So we will ask you if it's okay for us to look at your machine and make sure it's not infected, and if it is, look at it and see if any of that university data has been compromised. At that point, you have a choice to say yes or no. If we feel that, or you say, I probably had a terabyte of university data on here, but you can't look at my machine, the next step would be for us to go back to general counsel and say, we have reason to believe that university data has been compromised. We have someone who won't voluntarily let us examine their machine. We need to take the legal steps to examine the machine and make sure that university information has not been compromised. Part of that's not only to protect intellectual property, but under federal and state laws, we have an obligation to report if we feel a person's personal information has been compromised. And that's any combination of information that would compromise their identity, would compromise their financial accounts, would compromise any personal accounts in any way. So it wouldn't be, we realized sequester meant, you know, we'd show up in dark suits and dark glasses, you know, put you up against the wall and take your cell phone. We're not going to do that in practice.
So, I mean, under what circumstances should, you know, employees, say, stop accessing university email on their personal devices? Or, you know, are there circumstances in which we'd say to, you know, supervisors and offices and departments, you know, you should tell your employees, unless they have a job need, they shouldn't be doing this? And I can imagine there's a lot of employees, and a lot of supervisors are going to go, no, wait a minute, I want my employees to be looking at email, you know, or as an employee, I say, well, I want to be a good employee and checking my email, you know, or while I'm on vacation, things like that. I mean, so what happens in those kinds of circumstances?
I agree. It's a fine line, and, you know, I do a lot of work on my cell phone, and if my security team had to come take it, I'd hand it over to them. There's a difference between I want to be a good employee, I want to put in the time, I want to get things done, and working on your personal device, and your employer requiring you to do work on those outside of work. I think somewhere in the regs we say that this type of work on your personal device is not encouraged, but we know it happens. You know, we could tell you, and we could put in the technical means to block any non-authorized device from accessing any university resource. But we're a university. You know, we're a public institution. We all enjoy our jobs. Many of us would rather deal with something after hours on our own device than leave it and ignore people. It's the nature of what we do. We want to be helpful. We want to get things done in a timely manner. So we do it. And I think we've realized that that's inevitable. I mean, short of, you know, the radical cut off everybody technologically and no device, unless it's been authorized, it's going to access the network or any resources, it's not realistic. Go ahead, Richard, you were going to say something?
Well, on the other side of that, you know, there was a time when the university said, you know, if you're going to, we want you to do this on your own time on the cell phone, here's the device to do it with. And there's been a decision or some point in the time says, oh, everyone has one of these already, we don't need to provide them anymore. And that's just sort of been flowing through the university very rapidly.
And you know, I'm responsible for that decision in IT. And there's a difference between I require you to be on call 24/7 for the next 7 days because you're the only person that can fix this. And in those instances, we do provide, we pay for and provide an on-call phone. For those that you may have to call incidentally and we're not requiring to work, we don't. So we stopped providing a work-provided cell phone just because people wanted to be gotten a hold of. When there weren't cell phones and you were the person, the manager, who might get called if there's an issue with a server or the data center, we called your home phone and left a message. It just meant somehow you had to be contacted. Well, when we got into the mobile world, people felt like that was, well, because I might have to be called because I'm the responsible manager, you need to provide my cell phone. And that's simply not the case. You just have to be gotten a hold of. You don't want to give me your cell phone, you better check your voicemail at home. So for us, that saved our department $40,000 a year. And I think in hard budget times, it's hard to justify giving everybody a personal cell phone just because they might do incidental work on it.
I feel like this might be a little bit of a blurred line between staff who are also students. I mean, I have a lot of confidential items in my email, but at the same time, I take classes. So I have to access my email on the weekends and at night for other purposes besides work. So, I mean, that's just unavoidable.
We got lots of questions from the student side, and we're writing up responses to those. It's not intended to, you know, if a student signs into their own work in Blackboard, they've got their own grades on their computer, that's not what the policy is intended for. If you're a student employee and you've got access to non-public information and you did that work or have that file on your personal device, as a student employee, you'll be treated just like an employee. So in that regard, we'd come to you, we'd ask, say, we saw strange activity on here. We see you're a student employee in the registrar's office. Did you have or access any student records with your personal device? And you go, oh, gosh, yes, I took home a huge file this weekend to work on to get done. Then we'd ask you, just like the answer over here, we'd ask you if we could examine your device and make sure it's not infected or the data was compromised. And then the same route, if you chose to say no, and we felt with reasonable assurance that you had a large amount of university data on there, we'd go the same route and ask legal for advice and look at your machine that way.
I have a question. So in terms of the liability question, where you know, as you said, the lawyers might consider us liable if we had university data or assets and they were compromised. Is that liability reduced or ameliorated if we are following the set procedures in terms of best practices, encryption, et cetera? You know, if I'm doing this, or like Brandy said, I'm an employee during the week, but it's one email account, and I'm a student on the weekend, I have to be in my email over that weekend class. And while I'm on my email, something gets hacked. But I've done everything according to policy. Am I still liable as an individual?
I do not have a law degree. I am not a lawyer. I would say if you've followed best practices, your liability is greatly diminished. We did have I can give an example in general terms. We did have a research computer that was compromised. The research they were doing was in the health field, so there were lots of personal data on individuals in there. What we learned in the course of our investigation was they did follow best practices. Their data was one-way encrypted. The encryption key that allows you to unencrypt the information was not on the same machine. It was kept on a thumb drive locked in a safe. The personal information was kept in a separate file from the what I'd consider private information you wouldn't want to get out, so there wasn't a way to tie them together without the encryption key. And so although the machine was compromised, we were 99.9% sure that information was not compromised. So there wasn't a need for us to report under the state or federal statutes, notify the individuals that might have been in there. So that greatly reduced any liability on the part of the employee or the university.
And so if individuals are concerned that they might need to be encrypting their data or acting, you know, taking additional steps, OIT would work with them to implement them?
Yes, and that's what we're working on at the same time. We're working on these, our security groups, working on best practices for individuals. How can you protect your own stuff? You know, I said I'd tell a story. I said, I take pictures for a hobby, and I took pictures of a friend's wedding, and I uploaded them, and I have Google Analytics on my website, and it shows a map of where everything's accessed. And I signed into my photo site one day, and from Eastern Bloc countries in Europe all the way through Russia, my phone, my site was accessed. It just lit up red with all these connections. Like, oh, my God, my photo site's been hacked. Well, I dug into it, and it turned out the wedding, our friends married a Russian national. She told all her family to go look at the wedding photos. So my site was just inundated. So that's an example where, you know, if we had seen that from one of yours, we'd ask the question, is there a reason that this type of activity is happening? And it could be something simple like that. Well, yeah, I posted photos of a wedding I took, and their relatives all live in that foreign country, and they're downloading the photos. So there are legitimate reasons to see that traffic. And we're gonna take the approach that nothing nefarious is happening, that some, you know, it may be compromised, there may be a valid reason, but those are things we have to look at and ask the questions.
I think we had another question, yeah.
So I had a question about, you kind of mentioned like a security audit when it came to the mobile devices. We have a lot of staff that we just provide a stipend for them to use their own personal mobile device for business purposes, and we pay for the data and voice. I'm with Residence Life, and we pay, there's a lot of staff that do that. Is their mobile device subject to like the audit, I guess, to say, like that someday they might need to prove that they're following all the proper, you know, mechanisms?
Short answer is yes. So you said you're subsidized people's internet connection to use their personal device in work?
Yes, we provide them a mobile stipend through HR for their mobile device that includes voice and data and texting.
Okay. Yes.
Carl, does this new policy, in addition to an existing computer use policy, or does it supersede an existing policy?
This is in addition. I mean, if you look at Section 0207 in board policy, that's the information resources policy, we read through there and combed through there very long and hard before even proposing a policy to see if this this realm of policy was covered. In talking with legal and talking with other universities, it really wasn't. Although you could say, yes, any of these is a computing device and it should follow those information resources policy, we felt that the world is changing so much that we don't know what tomorrow's mobile device is going to be. It's going to be something portable. It's going to be something that accesses a cellular or wireless network. And we wanted to make sure that it was explicit, that people understood just because it wasn't a desktop that was, you know, under your desk and tied to your physical place of work, that there were guiding policy that would impact how you do business. When the iWatch comes out, that's basically going to be another personal computer that's going to have full internet access. You could do your work on it. You could do your email on it. It'll have limited storage to store things. And if we see strange traffic coming from that, we may be looking at that. If you wear Google Glass or one of the other personal glass devices, we don't know what that next device is going to be, but we know they access information, we know they access the internet, and we know they're portable. And the university needs to be in a position to be able to protect any of its non-tangible assets, information, and research.
I've got a question.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Carl, this is Chris Brooks. I'm the IT administrator for SFOS. How do you intend on tracking these devices?
At this point, we don't track them. We'd primarily be seeing this type of information on the university network. So you may have a personal device that you've got on wireless. Occasionally, we get reports from intelligence agencies that say, hey, this IP address that kind of tracks back to you in one way or another, we found compromised on a server in another company or another country. But we don't plan on putting, you know, those type of tracking devices so we can push a button and see where everybody is on the planet at any given moment.
Right, so there'd be no way to tell if they were, say, on their home network, whether or not their device had been compromised.
Correct. In that instance, we'd rely on someone coming in saying, hey, you know, I was doing work this weekend and strange stuff's happening on my computer. It said there were three connections and I have no idea who was on it. Or some other way, we've seen our information show up outside of the university network on publicly posted on a hacker site. The thing about hackers is they're very arrogant people and they like to post what they've accomplished. So a lot of times we'll see that hackers have said, hey, we found a vulnerability on this server at the University of Alaska. And we're like, oh, God, okay, we'll go check it out. And a lot of times we've already patched it, and so it's a non-issue. But occasionally they beat us to the punch, and hopefully we don't find university information that way.
Well, certainly. There's a lot of security problems within the university system. But concerning these mobile devices, how many instances of compromise have you actually seen in the past year?
In the past year, probably a couple dozen. We've had laptops lost. We've had other mobile devices lost, some infected, some university-owned, some personal.
Okay. When you say lost, these devices were also compromised?
They were, well, if they're not in our possession anymore, and we don't know where they are, we consider them compromised. We've had a department that had laptops and iPads stolen and not recovered as well. And those did not have information on them. Through a process of interview and work analysis, and fortunately the person had backups, we could look at the backups and see that they did not have information compromised. But had they, it could have been bad.
Yeah, I got Nate, did you have a question?
Well, I was struggling a little bit to understand the responses to Brad and to Faye earlier, just in terms of liability. And I understand that this is all, you know, worst case and rare and that sort of thing. But I guess, you know, I appreciate the acknowledgement that, you know, many, if not most, people are accessing, you know, university data or their email over their personal devices. And there are ways to reduce our liability while at the same time reducing the risk of these being compromised. But the implication that I heard was that the only way to reduce our personal liability to zero is to never access our work email from our phone. Is that right?
That's one way to eliminate the risk of using your personal device. If you have a university-owned laptop that is mobile and you take it out and you've not followed security devices, that's not going to limit your liability. So there's two pieces, work-owned mobility and personally-owned mobility, and we're trying to address both in this policy in reg.
Okay, any further questions on the phone? Any further in the room?
Just really quick, is there going to be an education campaign or anything once we figure this all out?
Absolutely, and that's why I started, you know, early on. You know, after this is going to come security tips, and I'll get that one handout we do have done out to people. And it's good education for your own devices as well, even if you're not doing work on them, to protect your own stuff. So, yes. If you have any questions or comments, I'd ask that you get them to Chris, and Chris knows where I work.
Yeah, please forward any additional questions you have. I'd be happy to forward it on to Carl.
All right.
Thanks very much for coming in and addressing this. Appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks, everybody.
All right. We're going to move forward. Next agenda item, unfinished business. Volunteer Day proposal, you want to talk a little bit about that, Nate?
Sure. Based on a couple things, our full agenda, and also the fact that as a committee we're still trying to put together feedback based on revisions that are based on feedback from our last staff council meeting, we're going to try and pick up the proposal at our next month's meeting, staff council meeting. We're meeting as a committee next week, so we're going to kind of finalize the revisions that we've made. I would use the opportunity just to put that on people's radar and just so that it's on people's minds in advance of next month's meeting. So, you know, we'll have, you know, in the next couple weeks we'll have a revised proposal. So I guess I would just encourage people to take a look at that and think about it if they can before our March staff council meeting.
Great. And if you want to take a look at it, it should be attached to the last meeting's agenda, which would be posted on the staff council website, I believe. So yeah, if you're looking for it for a refresher, what was originally proposed, that'll be on the staff council website attached to the December agenda.
Cool. Thank you, Nate. Staff council calendar update. Have you guys, a lot of representatives, a lot of you picked up the calendars? I was very pleased, and I thank Nicole for doing really the majority of that work. And thanks, Nicole. Also, the calendar was the last thing that printing services printed before they closed up shop. I work right above where they used to be, and it's a pretty sad, empty space right now. So, but I thought it was kind of nice to hear that the last thing they did was for us. I'm really pleased. there are a few left. I have a few left in my office in case you still need a couple more. So.
And I have some as well still.
The universities proposed Alaska core values, or University of Alaska core values. We haven't really had much feedback on this. Go ahead.
We talked about this at the last Staff Alliance meeting, and I think the sense from most of us was that what we were hearing from you guys was a lot of, well, so what? Why are we even looking at this? Why is this important? Does it matter? And I think there is a sense that it matters to some extent. It's good to know what our values are as an institution, especially in tough times, but that, you know, there wasn't kind of a driving purpose. Also, a lot of these are not controversial, and it's not necessarily a controversial thing to put out there that, you know, as a university we value respect, for example. I think that based on the feedback we had from you guys at our last couple meetings where this just wasn't gaining a lot of momentum, was that if you have any objections or feedback that you'd like to make on them, send them up through Chris and I. We'll bring it to Staff Alliance. But otherwise, you know, this is what Staff Alliance is working with and we'll move forward on. So I don't expect that we would take it up or vote on it as staff council, but just you have an opportunity to give feedback through. So they're on there, and we also have attached the UAF-specific values.
Ideally, they would work together.
Right, and not contradict each other at the very least. So, but if anyone wants to have discussion on it at this point, that's also completely fine.
Excuse me, this is Evelyn.
Yes, hi, Evelyn.
Hi. What you guys were saying about the staff council calendar. Could you repeat that, please?
Sure. So we were under the impression that most of them had gone out to representatives. I know Nicole mailed them to rural campuses, but both Nicole and Chris have some extra. So if you need more, you can contact either Nicole or Chris.
Okay, when were they sent out? Because we haven't received any out here yet.
Yours went out, Evelyn, on priority mail late the afternoon of January 14th. I have the tracking number in my office. I'll check when I get back to see if I can find it so we can figure out where those went. Because they should have gone to your attention.
Okay, if you could get that to me. We haven't seen anything yet. Or I haven't seen anything yet.
It was addressed to you, so you should have. So I'll check.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Evelyn.
Tricia, you had a question?
On the core values. So if once the UA ones pass, will the UAF ones get updated? If they're pretty slim, and I'm just wondering if that's a second step or if that's not in the plan.
So the UA ones were more of a response. You guys might have remembered a couple years ago the president had proposed a code of ethics that didn't go over very well. People were kind of along a spectrum from offended to insulted to it felt pretty patronizing, a lot of the things that were put forth in the code of ethics and just the approach of a code of ethics. And so at that point, I think the kind of response at the president level was, okay, well, if you don't want this, show me what you do want, because I want to have something in place. And then kind of over time that turned into the chair of Staff Alliance said, okay, well, we'll draft from our perspective what an acceptable kind of common set of core values would be instead of a code of ethics that we subscribe to. So I don't believe that this would then automatically or that a process is in place for this to then supersede any ones that are university specific. It would just be something system-wide where we don't have anything right now. So But
I'm not really familiar with the term self-healing. It's in integrity.
Oh, is it? Yeah, so that would be something. If you want to send us an email that says this term doesn't...
Not sure what that means.
Yeah, we don't know what this means. It would be important that we're using vocabulary that people at least understand. So that would be good to send up.
And you said that Staff Alliance would be looking for final feedback and then would proceed, or if they don't receive feedback, they'll proceed as is. What's your sort of deadline or end date for comments that we can send to you or Chris?
We haven't really gotten one, but I would say if we had something, I would take a look now and maybe in the next 2 weeks, just so it doesn't fall off your radar. If you look at it in the next week or so and send us comments, that way we can get them up to Monique, and then this can move off the Staff Alliance regular working agenda as well, because I'm assuming that from there she'll take it to the system-wide governance with faculty, the system-wide faculty representatives and students as well. So.
That's a good question. So in the next 2 weeks, if you wouldn't mind reading through that and see if you got any questions like that, what's self-healing mean or other things? Thank you.
Related to that, sorry, kind of to Trish's point, I think that I would encourage people to look at it because they, like as you say, Faye, they might not have a lot of internal consequences like for us directly, but they also have things like this, things like mission statements also have kind of external consequences. I know when I'm like unfamiliar with a company or an institution, the first thing I'll do is like go and read their mission statement or something like that. So reflecting ourselves in the way that we want to as a university and as an institution, I think, is important also.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions on these? Any on the phone? The last piece on unfinished business, the Chancellor mentioned as well, which is that the Chancellor's Cornerstone Award nomination deadline is February 20th. Please take a moment to go check that out. Nominate people in your unit if you're aware of them, or encourage people in your unit to nominate them. And then we also need a committee chair and 3 additional committee representatives to, once the nomination deadline closes, you'll get the nomination packets, review them, and we usually put forward 3 or so top, something like 3 to 5. I think last year we only put forward 2. That clearly came to the top. But we put forward a couple names from the list to the Chancellor as our recommendation for the award. I can say I served on this committee last year. It was a real pleasure to be on. It's a pretty short turnaround. You get the packet, read them. We met once as a group and then put forward our recommendation. So it's not a huge commitment. But you get to read really wonderful and inspiring things about our coworkers, and then put that forward to the Chancellor. So it's a real positive one to be involved on. So do we have any volunteers? Jane?
Yeah, I'd volunteer for that committee.
Great. Jane, would you be interested in chairing it?
Yeah, I'd be happy to volunteer to chair it. Great.
Thank you.
2 others?
I'll volunteer.
Perfect.
Did you get that?
This is Kim. I'd volunteer.
Okay. Anyone else on the phone? We have one. We don't have a woman. Okay. Great. Okay. And you got Kim? Anyone else on the phone who's interested in serving on that? Okay. Great. Thank you, guys.
Thanks. Yeah. All right. Moving.
And then you'll hear from Nicole once the follow-up to that is once the nomination deadline's closed, then you'll get the information and can schedule a meeting. So,
all right, move on to new business. There's a proposed UAF AED policy that's attached to the agenda. It is currently in draft. I would encourage you guys to look that over and see if you have any questions on that policy. Either send that to Nicole or we can address that at the next meeting.
Remind us what the AED stands for.
It's a automatic.
External defibrillator.
External defibrillator.
So that's the electric jolt thingy on your chest. Yeah.
They're usually very bright yellow in color that you can shock somebody back to this world.
Yeah. So that's attached. It's on page 7, and the Chancellor needs our feedback by February 15th. Okay.
So feedback on that needs to be by February 15th. Then we've got a number of vacant seats on committees. I would encourage you, as there's a lot of new members on staff council, one of the things that we ask of staff council representatives to do is to be on one of these committees. You don't have to chair it. If you want to, though, you know, there's a couple of chairs needed for our standing committees. Otherwise, you'll be in the orientation this afternoon. Every committee will have a little presentation on what they do what their responsibilities are. But we had a number of staff council members that resigned, and we have a lot of new ones, and so we have a lot of seats available on these committees, and I would encourage you to really maybe listen to that this afternoon and pick one that you one or more for that matter that you want to join.
Mm-hmm. And the commitment for those, it's one meeting a month. It's an hour. It's always available through call-in as well. And I'll say for the one where we need a chair, Rural Affairs, other current chairs can agree with me or disagree with me, but I found during the time I was chairing a committee that it was not really a significant obligation on top of the time spent as I would normally spend as a committee member. You just work with Nicole to have the meeting scheduled, make a really simple agenda in advance, and then a short report back to the group. So it doesn't necessarily take a lot of additional time other than your time serving on the committee. And we would really encourage, if at all possible, that we have a rural member chairing Rural Affairs. Definitely your voices on all the other committees are just equally as important, but if this committee is specifically dedicated to Rural Affairs, it would be good to have leadership from rural members as well. So if you're thinking about that, please just contact Chris or I if you have any questions.
Okay. See, staff make student count award. The link's right there. We encourage folks to nominate people from staff for this award.
It's a big one.
Yeah.
There'll be one recipient selected from each of the universities.
Each campus, yeah.
And I think it's $1,000 plus 2 round-trip Alaska Airlines tickets. So definitely take a look on the website there for the criteria and think about nominating someone or encourage your units to nominate as well, because that's a really nice one. And the deadline on that is also February 20th.
If you're going to... These nominations take a little bit longer than the Chancellor's Cornerstone Award. It requires a certain number of, like a nomination letter, then a couple of nomination letters or recommendation letters from other staff members. So it's a lot harder to throw a last-minute nomination together for this one. Just kind of keep that in mind since we're getting close.
Thank you, Nicole. The proposed mobile device security policy, Carl just talked about that. Any questions you can send to me. And then the proposed furlough regulations are attached. Are there any questions on this at all?
It sounds like so the regulations are still in draft.
They are at this point, yes.
Is statewide HR still taking comments on those regulations?
It is my understanding that they are, yes.
Okay. So I can put this in email later, but I think one good addition would be under the exceptions under individuals affected, add an exception for staff or employees who've taken a voluntary leave without pay, that they can be comped for the number of days that they took voluntarily. I don't know, within the fiscal year, within the calendar year. It seems to me like if there are departments that are taking voluntary leave without pay now, and then we have a furlough next year, next fiscal year, I don't know if there'd be quite as much consideration given, but something like that.
I think we did actually send that up already. I sent it up to Staff Alliance. That was my first thought as well, reading through it, was, you know, nobody's going to take it, or we certainly shouldn't penalize people who are willing to take it, you know, by then hitting them twice between voluntary and a furlough. Any other comments or feedback on that? Yeah.
I'm Debu Mishra. I have joined in since 10:30, and didn't want to bother you guys. But sorry, I have a class from 9:15 to 10:15, and I have to. I can't join in before that. But I wanted to, if it is okay, wanted to talk a little bit about the furlough and the core values. Is that okay at this point, or do I wait?
Debu, if you don't mind waiting just a minute, we were just about to have a question in the room or a comment on the room on that.
That's fine, yes.
If you don't mind waiting, we'll finish the staff comment.
Sure.
If that's okay.
Okay, great. So it states that there's no more than 1 day of furlough per pay period unless it's associated with a holiday closure. And given that a substantial amount of our holiday closures are near the end of December and beginning of January, is that read you can't have furlough with a holiday pay period, or does that mean that they could bundle all of those days during the holiday closure period?
Yeah, that's the intent of that, so that you could technically not have more than one furlough day per pay period unless, let's just say, this past holiday break, we had 3 hard closure days. You could take 3 of those furlough days.
Okay, so assuming that it's not voluntary, you know, they could effectively prevent you from getting a week of pay Christmas week and a week of pay starting the new year. So it could be in the consequence of an employee is that they could use that as an opportunity to accomplish all of their furlough at a time that really may not be able to afford that as an employee.
Yeah, one thing we've been pushing for really hard is that instead of it being, you know, here's a 2-week furlough period or a week-long furlough period this week, that they instead set it up more like a leave bank or a code to charge to and say, okay, over the course of this year or over the course of this 6 months, each employee has to take this number of furlough days or hours so that employees are able to take them at a time that makes the most sense. So, for example, I wouldn't want to miss an entire paycheck. I'd spread mine out evenly throughout the year. Chris might say, yeah, well, if I can take 2 weeks off and not get paid over the summer, I'll spend it on my peony farm. That works for me. We're trying to push hard to make it as flexible in implementation as possible, because what works, we're trying to make it so that depending on the individual needs, it's as painless as possible. But
And the regulation was written with that with in mind, with the intent that an employee would have the choice of that. I realize that it doesn't read like that at this point. So that's good feedback, Phil. Thank you.
Okay. Again, yeah, so reading the spirit of the furlough, it definitely appears to be a very non-voluntary, and I didn't appear to receive, I couldn't determine that I could choose the date.
Yeah, I don't think it's written in there at this point, and I'm not sure whether or not that would be written in regulations that it's set up as a bank or that bit. That might be something that's kind of in the implementation piece, but
I don't want to make one other note that caught me by surprise is I was once a State of Alaska employee, and most State of Alaska employees do have a 37.5-hour work week.
Yeah.
And given that number is actually explicitly stated in here, I don't know if their spirit over the years of multiple budget shortfalls is the intent to get all University of Alaska employees to also have a 37.5-hour work week. So I just wanted to make you aware that other state or public sector employees already have a smaller work week.
Yeah, that might come back up again. This is something that was looked at by the Planning and Budget Committee. That was actually a recommendation at the time, was, you know, move to it. And the original thought was that doesn't make sense at this time. It's kind of a no-go. But things have changed very dramatically since then. So I imagine the committee will consider again whether or not to recommend it. I think at the time they were looking at it last year and discussions, a lot of the feedback was, no, I don't want this. But that was before some of these other things like furlough and the budget cuts were as severe as they were. So, yeah, I think that's always one that's worth revisiting. Thank you.
So this is really just kind of a point of feedback. The messaging that I've been getting from my supervising leadership is one that would kind of imply that this is a little conservative and that it might have issues. You know, things have changed since December and since November. And the impression that I get is that this is more conservative than maybe it needs to be, even just in light of the past 2 months. And I don't know really that we should keep that in mind or change anything, but you know, just sort of as feedback.
Yeah, and I can tell, and Trish and I were on the task force that put these draft regulations together. We had a lot of discussion regarding that. It is on purpose that conservative, because you're talking real money here.
Yeah.
And current regulations say 13 days. That's 5% of your salary.
And
it wasn't 13 days initially. The task force brought that down significantly for that particular reason, because if you think 10%, and I told the task force 10% of my salary makes me leave this place, I can't afford that. And I'm not the only ones. And so we brought that down on purpose and made it on purpose that conservative. And if there is, I mean, certainly the landscape in budget has changed since December, and I think that doesn't necessarily mean this policy needs to be adjusted for that.
And I tend to agree. I just would hate for it to fail because we were overly conservative.
Yeah.
I personally agree that it should remain as it is, but I would hate to see it fail.
So I'll just add in from the budget standpoint to that, you know, if they did go worst-case scenario and it was, you know, like Chris said, 13 days or equivalent to 5%, at UAF that would be equivalent, rough back-of-the-envelope sketches, not formal reporting here, but that would be probably in the range of like $8 million in savings, which is about half of our projected budget gap for the next year. And so, I mean, it's pretty significant. And I think there has been a general consensus that, you know, these budget problems, furlough can't be our only tool in addressing them. So, I mean, I think actually the way it's written, it still adds up to quite a lot of money if implemented to its extremist bit. So I actually don't. From my perspective on the budget side, I don't think it's that conservative if implemented, you know, across the university.
Okay. Where are you? My leadership has given numbers to the tune of 20 days or 8%, which is greater than what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Is there reason to believe it would not be that bad?
Well, like Chris said, 13 days is what.
Is what's
in the regulations, in the draft regulations.
And that would mean that you don't get paid one day every pay period.
Thank you. Yeah.
And as just a general question real quick, do you know if this is only affecting, is it going to affect all employees, even if they're funded by an auxiliary versus general funds?
No, there's exceptions in the regs.
But the exception is for people funded 100% on restricted funds, which is not the same as auxiliary.
Okay.
So right now there's no exemption for auxiliary. Student employees are exempt as written, including grad student employees.
But this would affect a lot more than just us, than just staff council, just the people we represent. And so, and I'm sure that's why DeBoo is what he wants to talk about as well. So, any other questions before I give him the opportunity to speak?
Would individual deans and directors have any flexibility to decide some employees might be furloughed and others might not, or would it be kind of just across the board requirement?
That's a good question. As a task force, we talked a lot about that, and we believe that that is a decision that should be made at the university level, not at the department level. On the other hand, there's arguments that can be made to say, well, some departments can do furloughs easier than some other departments. There are departments that run this place 24/7. It's a lot harder to do furloughs there than departments that have very seasonal, you know, semester-based employees.
Or departments that have, you know, a substantial chunk of their budget that is not people, for example, where they could conceivably cut back on contracts or supplies, whereas other departments, the only thing in their budget is people. But I think your question was maybe even within a department, could a dean say, well, I'm going to furlough this office but not this one?
Yeah, well, it would depend. I guess the question is, at what level would that decision, would that flexibility be allowed?
Yeah, right now it's written at the unit level, or the term in the regulations is unit, without defining necessarily what unit means, and we use that term somewhat more universally than I think we should. But the feedback...
It was meant as university.
Yeah, the feedback we provided was asking to change that from unit to university, and that if there was going to be a furlough, it should be a UAF furlough. One thought on that was, you know, otherwise, if I know my unit's going to be furloughed, I'm sure as heck if I have an opportunity to jump ship to another unit, I'm going to go there if they're not going to be furloughed. And so that it makes doing business within the university even harder in some ways if some units are getting hit and others aren't.
But that's still up for discussion. Yeah, I was going to say, in the task force, we talked a long time about this. And really our feeling, I think I can say most people in the task force, and the task force was cross-state, across universities, felt that that decision, the way the policy is written, this is for very serious financial issues. And while I certainly don't want to downplay our current budget issue, I think it has to get a lot more severe before we consider furloughs. And so if we do that, the task force really felt that that decision should lie with the president, or if not there, one level down with the chancellors and not with deans and directors.
So I know that I'm new to staff council, and forgive me if I'm a little bit behind on this, but I'm reading through the structure of the furlough and all the different options, the 37.5-hour work week, which someone mentioned, reduced contract, optional days off, taking the full 2 weeks. Is that going to be the employee's decision of what works better for them? Like, I mean, maybe not for me personally, but, you know, there are some people, like you said, you can say, hey, I'll take these 2 weeks off and get it over with, Band-Aid effect. There's other people who can't afford that. So what happens when this now conflicts with office schedules and coverage? I mean, because that is real money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's, again, one of the things that still, as a, from an administration standpoint, when we talked in pre-staff with the chancellor, he said they were still kind of working through things. And we've also heard from Brad Loveland, our UAS HR director, that he's still trying to, you know, work with statewide and get a better sense of how this would actually be implemented and what it would mean. I do think that probably, you know, well, I think we'll advocate 100% for, you know, employee choice and what works for them, but certainly it would have to be done in discussion with supervisors to try and either ensure coverage if, you know, at least during the academic year or when, you know, depending on your unit. So, yeah, so that's, you know, that's something as well that if people are willing to say in advance, yeah, these 2 weeks I'll be gone, it's a low period, it works fine, that's great, you know. Or in some places it might make sense for the office as a whole to close, you know, if for that period of time.
Yeah, I think the intent was for the employee. What would likely be, and Eric Seestead, when he was here last year, talked to staff council about that, what likely the way furlough would be implemented would be at the beginning of the fiscal year, the president or chancellor would say, you have 3 furlough days to take this fiscal year. And the employee at that point would work with their department to see when it would be appropriate to take those. So.
Can we do one more new business before I get to the business?
Yeah.
So one more item of new business really quickly. Could I get a show of hands or those of you on the phone, just speak up if you'll be attending the new member orientation today? We just need to print some materials.
I'll be there.
I'll be there.
Anyone, I think. Yep. Okay, great. Thank you, guys.
All right. I'd like to move on to Debu. You still on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Apologies for having to wait.
No, my apologies, because I didn't have any other way. I came back from class, and I saw my schedule at 9-something, and anyway, I just wanted to let you know Mondays, Wednesdays, I teach at 9:15 to 10:15. However, these are two important points I wanted to just bring up. The first one is furlough, and I have heard everything that has been discussed today. So this is coming from an alliance perspective, faculty alliance perspective. We haven't discussed the furlough yet at a unit level or a UAF level. And yes, unit means major academic unit, so it's university, just to clarify. We had a discussion in alliance, very strong discussion, and most of the alliance members feel that faculty should be furloughed. Because we need the staff most of the time to support us, and of course the income levels are a little bit lower than the faculty. I'm not trying to make anybody feel bad about this, but this is the truth. And so one proposition that came up was that the furlough should be based on income. People with more income should take more furlough employees, and people with least income should be excused. So there is some language that is being developed, but the major problem is alliance doesn't, alliance can resolve something, but it's really the unions, the two faculty unions across the university that need to really pick up on this. So, the status at this point is, before even we move forward with a resolution, my proposition was that the alliance should meet, or whoever, some members of the alliance should meet with the two faculty unions and then discuss this thoroughly before moving forward. So in a sense, what I'm trying to say here is that we do not appreciate the furloughs being slapped on staff, you know. So basically, and I have heard from, and this is rumor, you can say, is that the deans are taking a 2-week furlough in the next academic year. So that I haven't verified that yet, but this came out of a discussion with one of the deans, and the deans are unhappy about that also. So this is where we stand. It's a bad situation. The only people that are protected at this point through their CBAs against furlough are the faculty. So we're trying to open that up. Having said that, there might be program deletions and other stuff in which we might also lose faculty completely. Okay. So that was one thing, and I will be happy to answer any questions. The second thing that we were discussing are the core values. And I really thank the staff alliance to have taken the the first cut at the core values. And personally, initially I thought this was a waste of time exercise, and I was very open about that in the alliance. But anyway, now looking at the core values, There are a lot of things that are missing in the core values. We are talking about integrity. We are talking about ethics. Some 4 points. However, the mission of the university is to educate students in a free and open society. So we are trying to kind of and for the public good. And those things are completely missing from the core values of the university. So I'm taking kind of a pseudo lead on that one right now, to make a proposition of a slightly different set of core values that will be, of course, shared through staff alliance to all of you, and we'll see how things are moving forward. I'm just letting you know now. I know the process will take some time, but at least the core values should be such that we provide, the value that we stand for. That's all. I will take questions.
Debu?
Yeah.
Yes, your scheduling for your time on the agenda, that's going to be a continual thing, a problem, since it's now on Mondays?
Right.
So what time would work for you to schedule?
I had sent an email to Chris.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah, and I said anytime 10:30 onwards would be fine, because 10:15 I finished my class, but there's always students asking bit of questions, so I didn't want to really schedule it at 10:15, but 10:30 would be a good time for me to come back to my office and take, or I can even go to the meeting directly.
Yeah, we can swap that in the agenda.
We'd rather see you anyway.
Yeah, thank you. I would like to go to the meetings, but sometimes it becomes really close, and I don't want to really run from here.
Trish, you had a question?
Debu?
Yeah.
This is Trish Winters. Thank you so much for your kind words. It's really nice to hear that staff is so appreciated by faculty and by the deans, so that's really encouraging. In what you were saying about the core values, is that a document that your folks are going to be putting together and you're going to be sending over to us so we can kind of see the ideas that you had of what you feel is missing?
Yes. The process will be this. First, the faculty alliance, and this will be probably discussed in our next meeting in Anchorage, which is a retreat, faculty alliance retreat. The document will be first approved by the alliance and then sent down to the three senates for an approval. I believe at that point, David Valentine is going to share it with the staff and student governance. So you guys will have a chance to look through it, and if we can come up with something that really signifies, for example, one example is academic freedom, which was not at all in any of the drafts I have seen so far, the administrative draft and the staff draft. But that's our value. We are promoting academic freedom. I'm not coming from a faculty perspective. I'm coming from a core value of the university perspective here. And I didn't see that. That bothered me. So I'm kind of taking a pseudo lead on this one. The reason I'm saying pseudo lead is that there are three people that are charged with this, and I'm one of them. I just kind of thought that I should draft it up and let others work on it. So yes, it will go, and you guys will have a chance to probably comment, or I can bring it up. I don't have a problem bringing it up. This is open university, so. We will have much time to discuss about it if we wade through all the fiscal problems.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much, Debu.
You're welcome.
Okay, any other last comments for Debu before we we'll do a quick run of the internal committee reports and then our roundtable and adjourn?
Yep. Anybody else? Anyone on the phone? All right. Thank you very much, Debu. Appreciate
Thank you
being here and waiting. And again, apologize for the wait there.
No problem. Don't worry about it.
All right. Let's move on to internal committee reports. Also, the internal committees did not meet. You guys have anything you want to add?
I think Trish had a report from their meeting attached for membership and rules. Okay, so most of these committee reports, the ones who did meet, their reports are attached to the agenda, so you can read through them. But we are now 12 minutes over time. So, if there's no discussion on the committee, we can, okay.
Yep, I'd like to on the staff health care committee, I want, please everybody take a moment and read it. There is some important information in there. Specifically, change to the deductibles, change to the medical pharmacy deductibles. It's pretty important that you guys take a moment and read it.
I think another one from external too was the Fresh Air Campus Committee in regards to the smoking on campus. So that one is attached as well.
I actually have a question for Leslie and other members of SHCC. I saw the change. Or the news put out via email for some of the changes coming to the health plan. One thing that I got some questions on is the change to out-of-network providers, and that's item 6 on the SHCC report. But I had two questions. One is the person who told me, says, we don't pay 80% of out-of-network charges. We pay 60%. And he was confused as what that 80% came from.
80%, like, see, if you go, there are several out-of-network providers, like the doctors at the hospital. They are out-of-network, but they do pay at 80%.
Okay. Yeah, he was saying it's 60%. It's never been 80%.
There are several in-town doctors, especially the specialty medicines. If you cannot obtain the health care anywhere else, with that, that's all you can get. Especially, it's the ER doctors that are a big issue. They do pay them at 80% instead of the 60.
Okay.
So they're changing their formula to make it 125% of the Medicare allowance.
Yeah, and so I guess the other question is, what does 125% mean? Does that mean if you go to a provider, you're personally going to get 25% back, or the university is getting 25% back?
Instead of being at 80 or 60%, they're going to calculate what the reimbursement amount. It will be 125% of what Medicare pays. So if Medicare pays $120 or $100, the university will cover $125, and anything over and above that will be the patient's requirement.
Okay, so if you're going to an out-of-network provider and you know what Medicare pays for, or Medicare says it should be,
right,
the university will pay 25% over that to cover that cost.
Yeah, the largest reason behind this is to try to get a lot of these doctors that are refusing to go in network to become in network, and a lot of them, like your orthopedics, are a big one. And it's also to help drive down the cost of our medical coverage. You know, that's one of their main reasons for going this direction.
Okay. Any others? Okay. Most of the reports are written, so. So we threw that. All right, then I'm going to ask Nicole to stop the recording before we go to a roundtable discussion.